NatWallet Show this week, end of year money reflections. Hi, I'm Christia van Heerden. With me as always, Simon Brown and some people from Instagram today.
And a hardy dog.
And a hardy dog and Rosie, who's suddenly very interested in what we're doing. This is our last full podcast for the year. From here on out, it's only mini podcasts until January, which has been insane.
Until the 20s.
177 fat wallet shows. It's quite a feat, I think. If you're new to this podcast, we'll warn you for the 177th time that we a bleeped version of the show is available at justonelap.com. Thank you to Sean Combrink for doing that for us. The market is getting such a whipping at the moment. I don't know what is going on. The telcos are suffering, and yeah, so both of our indices are not doing too great. The price-weighted index, which is the new one that we made, is down 1.5% since we made it in August. And the ZAC 1 LAP index is down 6.27% since we made it in August 2 years ago. So, yeah, it's not a fun time out there. Tonight is our last power hour for the year. You are doing the position, your portfolio. Can I get a preview of what you said about that 10% that you were hoping for?
It is 11.
Are you buying bubbles?
I think so.
Are you secretly hoping that it quickly dips below?
You know what the trick was, and I said it at the time. You know, like if it's 11%, like bar humbug. If it was 20, I wouldn't mind. But like 11, like that's like, you know.
I feel like somebody else should be paying for these bubbles.
Well, actually, the plan is that somebody else is paying for the bubbles, so that's why I'm buying bubbles.
Oh, lovely.
All things equal and poor.
Oh, great.
Yes. Right. And just for the reference, we said this evening. You said this evening. You meant today's evening, not Monday's evening.
Yeah. So Thursday on recording day evening. We are recording on the 5th of December. So last week when I was putting together the show notes for the tax episode, I figured out something really fun, and I thought I'd just share it with you guys in case you want to go play around with this. Every year, SARS basically gives you a few tax-free days. And I've worked out how you can work out how many days in a year you pay no tax on any of your income. So you take your annual income, you divide it by 365. That gives you your income per day of the year. Mm-hmm. And then you divide 14,220 Rand, which is the rebate that SARS gives you every year, by your daily income. And that gives you the amount of days, the amount of tax-free days that you work in a year. Which is fun to do. It's not...
Well, I don't know. Fun is a big word.
So the cool thing here is for a change, the smaller your salary, the more tax-free days you have. The bigger your salary, the fewer tax-free days. Yes. Yeah. But that's a fun exercise to do. You guys should go try it. If you're not sure what we're talking about, last week's show notes would explain all of this. Okay. Our winner of the week is Anna, who kicked off her investment journey this year. And she researches fund fact sheets, even though she's only started investing this year. She says, I finally decided to start investing after listening to your show. I'm starting out by maxing out my 33,000 tax-free for this year. While researching tax-free accounts, I came across an article on Stealthy Wealth, what these 9 experts hold in their TFSAs. Simon, as in you, Simon Brown, holds Satrix Prop at 31.8%, Ashburton Global 1200 at 36.6%, and Signia iTrix MSCI World at 29.5%. I decided to research the fund fact sheets of each one and noticed that the Ashburton 1200 and the Signia MSCI basically invest in the same companies, just different percentages. I'm totally new to this, so what am I missing? Isn't that just then investing in basically the same product if their holdings are basically the same? What would the reasons be in investing in both of these options?
So, I mean, so there's two answers to the question, Anna. And the first is that when I was buying the Satrix MSCI, sorry, the Signia MSCI index, we didn't have the Ashburton. And in fact, at the time, we we only had the Outrix. Those were the only ones. And there were still Deutsche Bank funds back in those days. So if you wanted offshore, you could either, they had a global and they had four regional, Japan, Europe, UK, and the US. So that was the one that I was buying. Then Ashburton came along with their 1200, which I prefer, and I prefer it primarily because it offers some emerging market exposure. The MSCI Global Developed Market excludes any emerging market, whereas the Ashburton has about 7% of emerging market, excluding South Africa. So I then stopped buying the MSCI, started buying the Ashburton, and I haven't sold the MSCI because although, you know, all the argues around the Satrix one is cheaper, etc., the trick with selling it is by the time you've crossed the spread and paid 0.5%, 0.25% to sell and 0.25% to buy, and you paid the taxes, etc., it's going to take you about 6 years to catch up on the money that you've saved. And I am betting that at some point in those 6 years, Signia will drop their fee. So far, I'm losing that bet.
So since we did that show, Can One ETF Rule Them All, in January last year, can you believe how long ago that was? But in January 2018, we did that show. And that's when I really started, because I kind of figured out that emerging market thing as we were recording that show. And that's when I started buying the Ashburton 1200. I had the Deutsche Bank World ETF, but then when I moved all of my money into my tax-free, so I had it outside of a tax-free account, and then I moved everything into a tax-free account, and when I did that move, I switched to the Satrix MSCI World. So the majority of my tax-free portfolio at this point is still Satrix MSCI World, but ever since we did that one ETF thing in January last year, I started buying the Ashburton 1200.
Yeah.
So mine would also look similar, and it's for similar reasons. But the thing is, both of those products are really excellent. All three of these products that we're talking about are really excellent. So you can't really go wrong with it. You know, it's a it's an either or kind of situation.
Yeah.
All right. So speaking of January's and last year, I was thinking to wrap up the year, I wanted to talk a little bit about the things that we learned and what we want to do going forward. So I went back and I listened to the 1 January 2018 episode. We did a mini episode on our New Year's resolutions in 2018. And my financial goal was to have better mental models to make financial decisions there. And then at the end of last year, we did an episode on the assumptions we need to challenge after 2018, which was quite a brutal year. We said a crash is a great way to make up for lost investment time. So if you didn't start investing when you wanted to, when there's a crash, there's, you can basically make up for lost time, which was an interesting idea and still is to me. We were talking about the fact that you, Simon, had never seen a market go sideways for that long period of time and how brutal that's been. And I resolved to try to be more diabolical and to focus on the best outcome as opposed to the best practice. So those were the things that we spoke about in the previous years. So I just wanted to kind of revisit those. The mental models at the time when we spoke about it at the beginning of 2018, I was using the rule of 72 and cost per use and cost per unit. And those two things I've really refined. So this year I really started to do a lot of bulk buying and stuff. Like, so if I can reduce the cost per use for a single thing, then I buy as many of them as I can and I keep them, if providing they don't spoil. But then what we also have done since then is we've turned that Five Concepts to Make You Rich podcast that we did years ago into a workshop. And those, and it's funny because tomorrow, as in the day after we record, I'm doing another one of those workshops at a company. And basically what we've come down to is we use those five concepts as kind of a model. And every time you have to make a financial decision, you run it through that mental model. So I've come up with some questions here that I thought maybe we could just talk about for when you have to make decisions going forward based on the five concepts to make you rich. So the first one is, because just to recap, the five concepts are assets, interest, inflation, compounding, and indices. So those are the five things you really need to understand. And once you've internalized the understanding of those five concepts, you should be able to make really good financial choices most of the time. Not every time, but that's okay. You don't need to make a good choice every time. You just need to make a good choice more often than you make a bad choice. So the first question that you ask, so let's say you have a financial choice to make. You guys can write down these questions and then use them as kind of a tick list every time you have to make a financial choice. The first question is, does this decision contribute to my asset base?
Mm-hmm.
Will I earn or pay interest based on this decision?
Mm-hmm.
Will my money grow above inflation if I make this decision? Am I stripping inflation out of the returns that I was promised to get? To get the real return of this decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when somebody says you are going to make 500%, are you taking, what is the period? And are you taking inflation for the period into account?
Mm-hmm.
Does my money have a chance to compound? Are there any fees that can compound?
Yeah.
And if I invested this money in an index tracking product, what would my returns be over the same period?
Yeah. How does it compare to that index tracking product?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is kind of the model that I now use to make financial choices. And what I've noticed is it doesn't always apply, but it's just a really good way to think about it. So I was using this as an example. A friend of mine had his car fixed and it cost him 20,000 Rand. Yeah, so I said,
you can buy a car for that.
Yeah. You can buy my
much,
car for.
Yeah. Okay. Probably. Not much of a car, but a car.
So I said to him, like, if you think about it this way, does this decision contribute to his asset base? No, it doesn't. 20,000 Rand that goes to car service does not contribute to asset base. Will he earn or pay interest on this decision? He definitely loses out on the ability to earn interest. Mm-hmm. So there's an opportunity cost there.
Mm-hmm.
His money won't grow above inflation because his money won't get a chance to grow because his money won't be his. He doesn't need to strip inflation out of it because that money is going out immediately. So inflation is something that happens over time. It doesn't happen in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
His money won't get a chance to compound. Similarly, there won't be any fees that will compound, but there is an opportunity cost there. And
well,
if,
it compounds out of his life in a sense, but
yeah. And if he invested that money in an index tracking product, he would almost reach his tax-free allocation for a year. So there's definitely like a, you know, so, and there's, it's just an example of how you would use this matrix to make a decision about whether you're going to spend the money. Obviously, if you need to repair your car,
yeah,
you don't really
in
have
this
a choice.
Case, yes, because otherwise you're walking and it's currently raining.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk a little bit about your financial year 2019 and the things that you saw and the things that surprised you and the assumptions you want to challenge after this year.
So the year was all right. I mean, it wasn't, there was no, I'm trying to think. I mean, the year just has left me feeling punch drunk, but truthfully. So there was no major unexpected expenses or emergencies or anything like that. So in that regard, fairly benign, although I have just paid for my mother-in-law's flat whilst waiting for the other one to sell because getting money from Europe was proving complicated. And that, oddly enough, is leaving me stressed because although I typically have a giant slush fund, you know, emergency fund, call it what you will, which truthfully could probably stretch and last my wife and I for maybe 3 years, suddenly I haven't. And that's like a weird place to be in and understandably, frankly, an uncomfortable place. I'm just not enjoying not having my slush fund.
But it's also in a situation like this where now suddenly you'd get like the biggest emergency of your life now that you don't have that.
Well,
yeah,
so I was putting my laptop in my bag to come here and I was terrified that it would fall out in the road and get ridden over by a lorry and smashed. And
yeah.
And of course, that's never happened in the history of my life, but I'm just terrified that it now happens. And suddenly, you know, I've got to go and buy a new laptop and I don't quite have the sufficient slush fund to do it. And truthfully.
But the thing is, you have access to credit. Which makes the so that it's not the ideal solution to a problem. If you don't have an emergency fund, leaning on credit is not ideal, but it is very good to know that you have that option.
Yeah, and truthfully, this is what the emergency fund is for, right? I mean, in a sense, so my sister-in-law was supposed to pay for it, but if she can't then get the money back, and so she doesn't want the money trapped in South Africa, all of those sort of complexities. And the person who had sold the flat wanted their money, understandably so, right? You've sold it and was getting antsy. So at some point they were going to kick my mother-in-law out, which was going to become my wife's problem, which then, you know, so this is what emergency funds are for.
But surely that is also not how it works, because like having gone through a house buying process that only wrapped up this year, if you can believe that, they can't, you can't really evict somebody while they're waiting for their money to clear. You just, that's why you pay occupational rent.
Yeah, so I mean, truthfully, I don't know. I hadn't read the contract. So the one unit has been sold, and the one we're selling is the bigger, more expensive unit. New unit being purchased, smaller, cheaper. And the sale of the one then pays for the other. But the sale has been held up, and the reason for the holdup is the seller's fault. So, you know, the person who's receiving their, who wants their money has been getting antsy and threatening and stuff like that. Whether they could practically do anything, don't know.
Yeah.
But, it, you know, people were getting stressed and there were transatlantic phone calls getting hysterical. And it's a case of, well, this is why you have an emergency fund.
Mm.
Yeah. It just happens that mine was big enough to pay for the unit.
But you also had a really good trading year this year.
Yeah, so the trading's been good. Trading index futures, although trading ORMI, which is a horror of a thing to trade, but that was a proof of concept. And now trading the full Aussie. And what I've been for so my trading journey, which has now been a 24-year journey, 25 years, has been weird and gone through. I keep on getting sucked into very, very short-term trading because I can do it. But then it's a time sink, right? It takes your days disappear. So I always step back and try and do end of day or even weekly trading or something. And what's happened is I'm now just trading the market pre-open, so the futures market, so 8:30 to 9. So I find a really cool spot where I literally need 10 or 15 minutes in the morning to enter my trades. And then, you know, I'm in and I set my exits and I leave it to happen.
Do you automate your exits?
Yeah, so automated exits. One's a trailing stop loss. And if that's hit, then my other orders cancel, or I've got taking profit exits, and if they hit, the stop loss cancels. So in an ideal day, and it didn't work this morning, I put those trades on, and then I go train. And when I come back, there's SMSs telling me one way or the other which way I exited. Mm-hmm. And it's the old thing, when I make money, I make 300 points. When I lose 200. As long as I make money half the time, then I make money.
You know what? That is such a, I think a lot of people who don't understand trading just glazed over now. But like, so we're going to move on from the trading. But that's such an interesting idea. And it's one of those really simple concepts that I have just been leaning on more and more often. It's like you don't like, because it kind of allows you to let go of the idea of perfection. Like, oh, I made a mistake and now everything is ruined. You know, when you get to this point where you go, actually, you just have to make a good choice more often than a bad choice.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you have three chances, if you can make two good choices and one bad choice, that's okay. You're still getting ahead.
And quickly go down the rabbit hole of trading. And if folks are more interested, go search for perfect trade on the Just One Lap website. So the logic is a perfect trade has got nothing to do with profit or loss. It's did I do it well, because I can't control the profit or loss. But interestingly, I'm trading on price action. So it is all on my plate. Did I read the price right or wrong? The thing is, this morning, as sometimes happens, I read the price right and it goes in my direction. But then 5 minutes later, the circumstances have changed because the market is dynamic. It goes against me and I end up losing money this morning. Mm-hmm. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
There were other bits this morning. So one of my contracts got downgraded to a degree. Or actually, just they came along and said, we're going to pay you 25% less, which is, well, yeah, as it is. But interestingly, partly with the moving to a smaller living and everything else like that, is I was totally able to absorb that. That was absolutely no stress whatsoever. And that was 2.5 years ago, just slashing my costs down. At that point, for no other reason than my cost base was just ridiculously high. And now that it's so much smaller, I can lose a quarter of a contract and it's fine.
So this is something we spoke about in both of those episodes that I referenced earlier from the past 2 years, is the one thing that you do that you can control 100% is your cost of living and how much money goes out of your account.
Yeah.
The rest of the stuff, what the market does and all of that stuff, you don't really have much control over. And what else for this year for you? Market stuff?
Market stuff. So my stock portfolio has had a rough year. It's green, but it's underperforming the overall market. That is thanks predominantly to ShopRite, Discovery and City Lodge. And in previous years, I've been saved. In fact, last year it was Richemont and City Lodge that saved. Sorry, it's Discovery and Richemont that saved me. Capitec in previous years, etc. But the portfolio's had a rough 2019.
Did you have any real dogs in your portfolio this year?
Well, I mean, define a dog. I mean, Sasol, sure. I mean, Sasol's a dog. I mean, absolutely. Although my Sasol position is smallish, under 2%. But, I mean, it's there and it's undoubtedly a dog. ShopRite, price-wise, but not fundamental-wise. Sasol's a dog in terms of fundamentals.
Are you going to get rid of it?
That I don't know. So that is the process I will do when I take a holiday over Christmas, New Year. And part of that is I set 3 days aside, like five days or a week apart, and to go through the portfolio, to go through the individual stocks and stuff. And the reason why, so on day one, I'll just crunch through and decide which stocks I want to delve more into. And then I leave it for 5 days or so that it can sort of float around in my brain so that I can think of things and make notes. And then I come back and then I'll really crunch hard and do a very, very deep dive. And then I park it again. And I come back then again about 5 days later and make that decision as to whether I will or won't. The key thing is
great that you give yourself so much time to make that decision instead of just
and that's to the point
having an emotional reaction.
And you're asking me now, and it might seem weird that I actually have no idea, and because it's my entire investment process is very much process driven. I would like to be so glib as to say it's all just process driven. It's not quite, but it's about that process. So, you know, I know which stocks I probably need to go have a deeper look at, but I haven't yet started, you know, really delving into it. There's a process. It'll kick off. It starts on Friday the 20th, and it'll be done by Monday the 13th. And, you know, it'll happen over that period. Mm. But also, so underperforming my benchmark. My benchmark's top 40. Underperforming benchmark is going to happen some years. And over the, I think I've got 19 years of data. I think this is my fourth time I've underperformed. It's no panic stations. If, however, this was the third or fourth year in a row that I was underperforming the benchmark, then I've got to ask some serious hard questions about my ability and should I not just shut the whole thing down and move into ETFs.
Top 40. So, again, this is the... It's okay to do badly sometimes, not all the time.
Yeah. And then the last point, which I have been doing, is my ETF portfolio was about 50% of my overall portfolio, and that number is creeping higher. I actually haven't peaked, but I've been saying 55, but it might actually be closer to 56 or 57%. And the reason is because new cash just goes into ETFs, and that includes dividends and all of that sort of thing, and money I put in and the like. And I'm just my medium-term target over the next 3 to 5 years is to get that to 65%. And truthfully, having hit that, I might then even push it higher up. And the logic there is quite simple. The biggest risk to my portfolio always remains me. And as the portfolio grows, although it hasn't grown a heck of a lot as of late, but the offshore stuff has, but the local stuff less so, I want to, you know, the rand value of what I'm managing becomes bigger. So my trades become larger. And it's spooky sometimes to put that trade on or to look at that rand value. But also just, you know, I'm old and grumpy now. So I need to start, you know, coming to the life of Riley. And part of that is looking forward to when I'm 75, do I still want to have an actively managed portfolio of half of my net worth? The answer is I don't think so, which means at some point between now and then, I need to make that change needs to have changed. You know, I need to have, and maybe it's zero, maybe it's 100% ETFs and zero individual equity. That decision I haven't made, but I certainly know it needs to be less.
Mm. Okay. So for me, this year has been really interesting because I've been in previous years extreme in my my approach to my finances. So maxing out my 27.5% RA allocation, maxing out my tax-free allocation, making sure that I've got that emergency fund in place. And this year, when my home loan finally cleared in March, I started...
Yes, it was only this year.
Can you believe it, eh? But I started doing that strategy that both Patrick and Stealthy do, which is I take all of the money that I'll be saving for the year and I put it in my home loan first. And then come February, I quickly transfer it so that I can get my allocations for the tax year. Mm-hmm. And then 1st of March, I start over again. So I've been sitting this year with a bigger pile of cash than I ordinarily would have had. But I've only contributed, so I've made a nominal amount that still goes into my RA every month, like R1,000, just to keep that kind of ticking over. And then, so I've been doing that to get the home loan amount down and to pay less interest and pad my emergency fund, and that's worked out really well. But then this year, I took a trip. I went to Cuba and I went to Canada, and it was really nice. So I was going to use, initially I was going to get a tax rebate from SARS, and I was going to pay for it with that. Mm-hmm. And SARS still haven't paid me, although Devet, who's one of our tax elves, has offered to take his bag of snakes to SARS to go and sort this out for me.
Devet will sort it. That I have no doubt.
Yeah. So
probably with lollipops thrown in.
Yeah. So I didn't get that money, and I used the money that I was saving for all my other stuff to go to Cuba, and then I added a little trip to Canada to go see my brother afterwards. And that trip ended up costing me, I was budgeting for that trip to cost me 30,000 rand, and it ended up costing me, so 30,000 rand I was budgeting to get there, and then another 20,000 rand to spend while I was there. And it ended up costing me 65,000 rand. So I underbudgeted. I underbudgeted by quite a bit.
That's why I go to Durban, man. For 65,000, you could buy Durban.
Yeah, I know. But I have to say, first of all, that Cuban experience, because I didn't just go for holiday. I went to do dance classes and all sorts of things. So there was a reason why I did that trip. And that experience for me, it was such a once in a lifetime experience, and it was such a, I really just needed a break from all of the stuff that was going on here.
No, it's proper. I mean, Cuba is proper. And also, you know, Cuba will be different in 10 or 20 or 30 years time.
But what was also amazing is that that trip really allowed me to disconnect, especially the Cuban part. So you do
no internet.
You do get internet access there, but I made a choice not to. And so I was completely offline just for 1 week. And that was, it was so good for my mental health and for my replenishment and stuff to go away. So the financial part of it is stressful for me a little bit. But then I also kind of had to come around to this idea that, you know, my financial independence journey is my journey. It's not, it's about what I want and about what makes me happy. And it's not really about like hitting those targets for the sake of hitting the targets. And you and I often speak about this, how you would swing one way and then kind of...
exactly what I was going to say. And you've swung the other way at saving what, half of your income for a while. And then you had a holiday to Cuba.
Yeah.
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 But it's also, so I mean, there's a chance you get hit by a bus on the way to the JSC this evening, and that'll be terribly sad, and we'll all cry a whole lot. But we'll still publish the podcast.
Thank you.
But we will end at 177. And then, like, you've got a lot of money in the bank. Like, your parents are going to love you, but, like, we've got to find that middle road. And truthfully, we don't. We do swing either way, but we've got to also live life, not just...
Yeah, and for me, when I stress about this, because I do go, okay, well, that is money that I could have put towards my future, and I didn't do that. But when I stress about it, I also remind myself that I didn't take on any debt to do this. I was in a very comfortable financial position to do it. I can meet all my obligations. You know, I'm going to pay a little bit more tax because that money is not going to go into my RA, and so I'm not going to get that tax, the full 27.5% tax benefit. But, you know, it was worthwhile for me to do this, and I really did need to, I mean, I probably could have had a similar experience had I gone somewhere way, 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 way cheaper, but this was what I wanted to do with the money, and I'm really glad that I did that. And so I'll see next year what happens. Like, I'll see, you know, it's, I'll see if I push harder or not. Because it's actually, I feel very comfortable with this.
Yeah. I mean, my next year, 2020... I mean, there's nothing large or major or big that I want to change. I've got to do some practical admin stuff more practically around my wife's accounts and stuff, because you know, I manage those for her because she doesn't, and that's just how it works in our family. And she's currently earning some cash, so there's some stuff. But you know, there's some sort of boring practical stuff. But otherwise, broadly, same old, same old. I mean, there's no giant expenses I'm looking at. There's no, you know, except for curveballs or anything. I mean, 2020 should largely be more of the same. There is a risk that I'd lose some more contracts, which would dent my income, but that's, you know, I'm not going to be eating beans or anything. And as I was saying to you earlier in the week, the trading, which has the proof of, so I was training Orme, it's worked, now you scale it up to Aussie, so that's now 10 times bigger. In theory, it should work, and then you scale that from 2 to 6 contracts and all of that. And if that works, that'll more than compensate for any loss of contracts and stuff like that and other income.
So what I did notice this year with my slackening approach to my finances is a tiny bit of lifestyle creep, especially, I don't know if you guys remember this, but around the middle of the year, I picked up that I spend like a ridiculous amount of money on groceries. And like and so next year, I think I would want to just take a look at that and make sure that I'm not kind of allowing unnecessary lifestyle creep. It's one thing to have a big expense every 5 years or whatever, and a big treat every 5 years. It's not the same as, you know, having your lifestyle become more and more expensive every year just because you're not paying attention.
Yeah, so that's actually one good point, which I hadn't thought of, which so the lifestyle creep for my wife and I was bloody Uber Eat. Well, or, you know, whatever it is, but, a delivery, food delivery. Because back in the day, it was just pizza, and there's only so much pizza you can eat. And that suddenly, it was like, whoa, hang on, this is... And then we went next door to the deli at 44 and got ourselves a really, really good, healthy, fresh dinner for, like, way cheaper than through an app. And it's like, whoa, hang on a second here. And it's weird because it didn't hit me because it was popping up on my 22/7 or anything like that, but it hit me when I went and bought a really good, simple, quick meal, and it was like way cheaper than going through an app, and it suddenly realized, yep.
Speaking of cheap food and good news and where our money goes, there is a new Dosa Hut in Four Ways, which makes me so happy because I love Dosa Hut and I normally go to the one in Fordsburg, but it's normally a mission to go there because it's quite busy and you can never find parking and blah, blah, blah. And then a friend of mine had a birthday and we went to the Four Ways one and it's exactly the same. It's a nice, beautiful, big restaurant with tons of parking. And I had a full meal and a drink for 99 Rand. It was awesome. I love the Dosa Hut. So if you guys are into that kind of food, then that's the way to go.
Dosa Hut's our problem because we live close enough to Fordsburg that it's on my app.
Yeah. I know. That's why I was thinking about it.
Yeah. So that and then just in... Yeah. So, and it wasn't, and then it wasn't even a conversation my wife and I had. It was a bit of, but it was just like, it was weirdly like suddenly like, hey, like we're actually doing a lot here. And it's, you know, the food's nice and everything. And we just pulled back and, you know, boom, problem solved.
Yeah. But it also just helps prevent you from becoming a hippopotamus, you know, because you don't want to be eating out all the time because you don't pay attention to what you're putting into your body.
But it's to your point of that lifestyle creep is you slide into something without even realizing.
Yeah. And it happens very quickly. You kind of have to be vigilant. I have to say 22/7 is really cool at helping you keep track of this sort of thing. This year was really good to my social life. I've just been like such a social butterfly. But it made me realize how I got into so much debt when I was younger because it was exactly the same. Like now I'm spending my own money. I'm not spending the bank's money, but this is where the money goes.
Yeah.
Oh, I would love to see you. Cool, let's go out to a restaurant. You know, and it's like I've noticed that these days, even if you just go out for a quick meal, I average about 175 Rand per person. You know, even if it's just let's quickly grab a bite, a lunch or whatever, not a fancy restaurant meal. And there is like diminishing returns over time. You know, if you just eat out all the time, you just end up not enjoying it so much.
I mean, there was a time when my wife and I ate out 4 or 5 times a week and we loved it.
Yeah. So, okay. So 2020, you're going to keep stuff really the same. 2020, I'm going to try and rein in lifestyle creep a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, there's stuff I want to do, but I'm probably not going to. So, I mean, one of them is that there's just, there's like really cheap beachfront apartments in Durban, and I keep on saying, yes, I should just buy one of those. But I don't want to be a landlord.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, I mean, you can always buy it and leave it empty because you're there so often. It'll get used.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I hadn't even thought of that. Yeah. But otherwise, no. I mean, because I was running through stuff. I mean, you know, our car's fine. We've got the one car. It works. It's lovely. There's no, you know, we don't have any car issues in our life. Our apartment is paid for. There are, from the body corporate perspective, some things that need to be done. But, you know, I proposed that we double our levies and got shouted down. So we're not doubling our levies. So that's fine. And we'll muddle along, etc. There's no maintenance that needs or anything like that. It's just the usual old.
So my car will be 12 years old next year. It's approaching 190,000 kilometers. And so I'm starting to get a little bit nervous.
Getting to that point, eh?
Yeah, I intend to drive it until it dies or I die. So whatever happens first, hopefully not at the same time, because that's not how I want to go. But
well, hopefully your car dies first, because truthfully, I mean, I would reckon you got a lot more time than a car.
So I am a little bit nervous about that kind of expense. But I feel like also that I would make a call on what the right thing is to do when that happens, because you know, things are changing pretty quickly in terms of cars and transport and stuff. So, you know, hopefully I can push it out for a few more years.
Yeah, and your father can keep that car on the road for a lot longer than you know, I could keep a car on the road.
It is so, it's so amazing when he services my car, because it's not like, okay, we're going to put in a spark plug. It's like we're going to put in the best spark plug and the best oil and the best of everything. So I always feel very comfortable.
And it still costs you a couple hundred bucks, right?
Yeah.
So I got my car serviced last week before. I don't know if I got the best of anything, but it cost $2,500.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I had a pretty major service. So while I was in Cuba, my dad serviced my car. And it was a timing belt that needed to be replaced, which I think would have cost probably R2,500 if I had taken it to the dealership.
Well, way more, but yeah.
And my dad ended up picking up a timing belt for my car for R700. And just like, apparently it was a nightmare to replace, but he managed to do it in the end. And yeah, it's worked out well. So the problem is also my dad is getting a bit older now, and I don't know for how much longer he'll want to do it.
I hadn't thought of that.
And if they move to a smaller place, maybe it wouldn't be possible for him to do it if he doesn't have the garage. So there's also that to consider. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of, it's one of those decisions that I'll deal with when I get there. There's no point in worrying about it now. So yeah, that's it for me for the year. I think if there are any assumptions that I would change after this year, I feel a little bit disillusioned with some of the ETF methodologies that I've seen. So like I've noticed that ETF issuers have to back a methodology once they start, like regardless of whether it's working or not. And I'm seeing a lot of ETFs, especially in the smart beta space, that are just not doing so well. And when you speak to the ETF issuers, who are all lovely people and friends of ours, I don't mean to diss them, but when you speak to them, and you say, look, this ETF isn't performing well, they're like, oh, it's just not performing well right now. And it's starting to feel very much to me like an active management strategy, and I'm starting to feel uncomfortable with that. Yeah. So that's something that I'm definitely going to be more wary of going forward.
That's a great point. And so when the ETF issuer says it's not working right now, I mean, maybe they've got a point, maybe they haven't. The bigger question is, are they saying, well, it works in a bull market, but then everything works in a bull market, you know? So, yeah, I agree with you 100%. They're all going to defend it. And, you know, we're not dissing or picking on them, but, you know, and there's some legacy stuff out there, which I really wonder why it remains listed in some cases.
We know you mean the Swix. You don't have to be coy about it.
I hate the Swix.
The thing is also, a lot of these smart beta strategies, because of what's been happening in the market for the past 5 years, I would say, because I'm still counting this year's one, even though the market is up, it wasn't great.
Well, the market's up, but only because it sold off like bananas at the end of last year, right?
So a lot of the smart beta strategies that have come out were supposed to be for a bear market, and we're supposed to, like, you know, we're just seeing like a lot of talk about waiting and volatility and bloody bloody blah, and I just am not, I'm not convinced. And
so I'm having a look at those APSA ones, and they've done okay.
Well, so I mean, they only listed the other day.
No. So they, but no. So from April, the high growth one is up. I don't know what it listed at, 940 to 1080. So that's more than 10%. The defensive one is down 20 cents, so 2%. And then the moderate one is moderate is up 5%.
Okay.
No. But there's been some, I mean, the one other thing is, I mean, momentum came back this year, which, hey, I like it because I hold it, but that was a surprise. Mm. I run a list of all the, well, not everything, but a whole bunch of things that I care about on my list, and yeah, momentum's suddenly gone crazy again.
But do you think that that's an indication that there's just momentum picking up now, like, and we're going to see a bit of a run?
So I do. I mean, from a purely technical perspective, when the US markets make a new high, they typically go up another 15%. That takes us to about 3350 or 3400 on the S&P. I think we've got more upside in our market, and we are kind of broadly tracking it. Although, I mean, we were having a great year. We were up 10% by mid-year. And now we, and I remember making the joke with Bright Kamala on air and saying, you know, let's just close this thing and go home and take 10%. Yeah, we are 6 months later and we only got the 10%. We should have fucking closed it.
Yeah, yeah. Lots of work and lots of watching the markets.
We could have gone and got a suntan or something instead.
Well, I mean, we did get one extra percent. That's not too bad.
It was a lot of effort for 1%.
It always is.
It always is, yes.
All right, cool. So this was like a really fun year. Like it was a fun year of fat wallets. And I think I'm grateful for the sideways market that we've had for the past 4 years at just where when I've been at Just One Lap, because I feel like I gained really deep knowledge into the market that I don't think I would have gotten if we had had like a nice frothy bull run. Like, I mean, I've had to understand some of the mechanics a little bit better.
It's, you know, so in an ideal world, you enter a market on day one of a bull market and you start off with a rip-roaring rally and everything else. But from a process and emotional and psychological response way, that's a terrible way to start, because you attribute all of that to your skill, and truthfully it was just luck. But I got to say, this market is tiring me. I mean, it you know, when I look at 2019, and it's just, you know, and I was chatting with a friend last night, and I was saying to him, it's just been a really tough year. And he's like, well, what was tough about it? And then I look back at the year and it's like, well, actually, no, what's been tough about it is that we still don't have our rally, and we still...
It's like waiting for Godot, basically.
Yeah, did Godot ever arrive?
No.
I didn't finish that book. I got tired of the waiting
Godot
part.
Godot never gets there.
And yet when we look back, and we've had this conversation before, if we look at Just One Lap, I mean, Just One Lap's done lacquer. You know, we're creating awesome content, and users are loving it. And I've had a fun year in terms of the other stuff I do at Business Day TV and FinWeek and all, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, but it's just
not seeing those returns.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, you know, this is the screen I open every day and stuff, and maybe that's part of the problem, and maybe I need to pull back on some of that, and maybe that's something I should ponder about. Whereas, you know, somebody else out there, let's take my sister, for example. She has no idea what the market's done this year. Doesn't know, doesn't care. Now, I can never be that extreme. I mean, I can't go to that point. But maybe the 6 days a week, and it's six because I write copy on Sundays, maybe 6 days a week of looking at train wrecks is starting to wear on me.
Yeah.
Or maybe I'm just old and grumpy.
And this is also something that I always try to remind people of, is what you can control is your contribution. And you can average it out over time, and you know, if you're looking for something to focus on, instead of focusing on the performance of the market, focus on your own savings rate, you know,
and what you can control.
Yeah,
yeah, and that might be just to the point that, you know, that I'm actually just spending too much time, and then there comes a question, because I don't think I need to, I think I do because it's habit, and maybe in part because I enjoy it and stuff, but maybe it's also just habit. Much like, you know, like we had a big house and it never occurred to me to not to. And then it was like, why?
But this is very much like social media. It's like one of those things that is so enjoyable until it becomes like not almost enjoyable. Like compulsive, you know, like yeah, yeah. Where you just, and I find this with, so, like sometimes I have to be really strict with myself with social media. Like, no, you can't go on social media right now. Because the feedback that you're getting, you're expecting to feel good from it, and you actually just don't, so that's, if you do it too often.
One of the things I did this year was delete Facebook from everywhere. So I now only use it on a desktop. And typically I log in just to post just one lap stuff, and then I might have a poke around. And I think I need to ask myself some questions around Twitter as well.
Yeah,
it's a time sunk. And it's a lack of place. And my Twitter is not half as toxic as many people's Twitter and stuff, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But it sucks time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before we move on to our questions this week, let's just quickly talk about that Signia exit fee thing. I just want to put people's minds at rest about that, because I've seen a lot of stuff, speaking of social media, of people who are going, no, I'm going to sell all of my Signia stuff. So first of all, just let's all just get it out there. They handled that situation so poorly, because Signia sent an email to
was in the Alchemy platform,
to all of their clients,
probably saying, tens if not hundreds of thousands of clients,
saying now the exit fee is going to be 0.34%.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, what the hell is an exit fee? And I didn't understand it, and you didn't understand it, and I asked on Twitter and nobody there understood it, and it was just a nightmare. And so it seemed for a while like if you sold Signia stuff that you hold, you would pay a fee for doing that, because of how the email was phrased. But that turned out to have just been like bad communication. Mm-hmm. And actually Signia are trying to do something good. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, I don't know who they got to send that message, but I don't think that that person is employed anymore.
They got someone who simply, it was horrendously badly done. But the short answer is you're not paying an exit fee unless you have got billions of Signias, in which case, well, hey.
So how, from what I understand, what's going on is if you are an institutional investor, you go to Signia and they create units of stuff for you because you need so many units.
You don't need the quantum.
You don't buy it in the secondary market through a broker like you and I would do it. And so if you are one of those people, so this is pension funds and giant, giant funds in the country. If you're one of those people who buy your units directly from Signia, not through a platform or a broker or anything, when you sell those units, you pay a fee for that, kind of like a brokerage fee, but and Signia capped that fee. Mm-hmm. So basically they're trying to save people money.
It's a good thing. They capped it. In the past, they could have charged a galinty points. Yeah. Now they only charge 34.
Yeah, so they've capped it at 34 points, but it only affects giant institutional investors. Yeah. If you are holding Signia products, please do not go and sell those products on the back of this. It was a miscommunication. Nothing bad is happening to your money.
They should have just been a little line at the bottom that said this doesn't, I don't know.
You know what? They should have just sent it to their institutional investors instead of sending it to the entire platform, because they just freaked everybody out, including me.
Magda said something about how the JSC requires notification or something, but I mean, whatever the rules, whatever the requirement, it was a communication strategy disaster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Colin is helping his parents with some tough financial choices. He says, my parents are reaching retirement age. They mostly worked government jobs and have decent government pensions. They have a portfolio of properties which is supposed to be their retirement income along with the pensions. They've kept the bonds maxed and they use the allowable tax deductions through the years really well. Getting close to retirement age, larger chunks of the bond are getting paid up. Because they're going to start drawing income from those properties in the next 5 years. They're finding it more and more difficult to find enough deductions on property alone to cover the profit. So now he wants to know how they can best save on tax on these properties until they retire. So let's deal with that first. So I want to say, remember that RA allowance, that 27.5% is on all of your income for the year. So that might be a very easy win for you guys if you add that to your retirement.
But also capped at 350, which is smaller.
Oh, right. I always forget about that cap because it doesn't affect me. It's so far away from
But it's also per person. So, parents, that's 700K.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you also have to remember that the interest allowance is higher for people over 55 and over 65 and over 75. Like you, it's that maybe 65, maybe not 55.
Yeah, interest, it's only, there's only one, but yeah, there are.
Yeah. So there are allowances for older people.
Yeah. Says, I mean, yeah. So, I mean, the RA is the easy way to avoid tax. The other ways, you've then got to actually spend money. And I don't know. So the one thing might be then be is maybe there's some upgrades or some maintenance that could be done to, you know, which will benefit down the line. You know, maybe a maintenance that needs to be done in 2 years could be brought forward a bit. But I'm not convinced about that either.
Yeah, and but the tax that they pay on this will also reduce dramatically once they stop working. So I quite like that idea. If you need to do maybe any maintenance or upgrades or whatever, doing it now while they are still earning an income, mm-hmm. so that when they stop working, they don't need to worry about that extra tax because they'll be in a lower tax bracket. If you don't know how tax brackets work, we sorted that out for you last week. So Colin says, should they take the money out of the Access bonds and put it into a fixed savings account? At TymeBank, they'll get 9.75% for 100,000 Rand and the remainder with African Bank, where you get 9.2% on a two-year fixed deposit. The five-year fixed deposit is 10.75%, but they don't want to put their money away for 5 years now that they like only 5 years away from retirement. He says by doing this, they'll be minimizing the profit made on the properties as the interest paid will be much higher with the bonds still being maxed.
Yeah, but the interest is taxable, hey? Now, what have you got? Assuming his parents are under 65, they've got 23,000 and some change each. So you get to that, you know, at 9% interest, you get to that quite quickly. You know, with by 300K, you're hitting your, and then that gets added to your income and taxed accordingly.
With the property, it's going to get taxed exactly the same way. The income from the property and the income from TymeBank are going to, they both get added to your income.
But parking it in TymeBank, you get, in the Access bond, you get the benefit because you basically save rather than receive cash.
Yeah. It's always an interesting one to think about. So we say you get a really good interest rate in your Access bond but it's a tax-free interest rate because you're not actually receiving money. You're just saving on interest.
Yeah.
He says to wipe out the remaining profit made, they should calculate what's needed in RA contributions to have enough deductions to get as close as making a loss as possible annually. I don't think they need to make a loss necessarily, do they?
No. I mean, I would just get it to break even.
He says if they're moving about 2 million rand out of the bonds, they're going to be paying tax on the interest earned in any case.
Mm-hmm.
So they could then just take 200,000 rand out into fixed savings, 30,000 into tax-free savings, which leaves 1.5 million sitting in bonds and mortgages. Come retirement, they could just take the money out of the tax-free savings and fixed accounts to pay off the bonds. Should they put a lump sum into the RA to offset the profit made? What would be the best way to mitigate the tax payable? The RA is the easiest
one.
The RA
is nice and clean. So remember, and I forget the exact thing, but you can also put in, if you put in excess money to the RA, you can claim it back next year.
It's rolling.
And because they're 5 years away, so I'm assuming they're around 60-ish, you might be loading your RA for the next 5 years, but then you can get some relief down the line post.
Yeah, because it keeps rolling. Hey, it doesn't expire. That rolling doesn't expire. So you can do that for 5 years leading up to your retirement and then get that tax benefits in retirement. What a genius solution.
Yeah, but remember, that does mean that you can't cash in the RA. So it needs to stay functional, which means that they can't get the annuity which they might need. So it depends whether they can in 5 years live off the income from the house.
Would you be able to take your third and then leave the rest in an RA?
No, so you need to, when you kind of pull the plug, it all just unravels and you can't half pull the plug.
Okay.
Yeah.
It might be worthwhile then keeping, but the thing is, if they're getting rental income in 5 years time, maybe they can do that. Like they just stop contributing to the RA, live off of the rental income.
Yeah.
And then once they've cashed in that tax benefit, then they can.
Yeah. And also remember, you didn't have to have one RA, right? There's two of them. There's a mother and a father. So there's two. So you can at 65 or something start the one, but leave the other. So you've loaded the one. And even as an individual, you could have two retirement annuities.
Mm-hmm.
So the one you're targeting to cash at 65 and the other you're targeting to cash at, say, 70.
Oh, that's a genius idea as well. You're on fire today. Good for you.
Coffee. Actually, it was chocolate milk. Milo. It was Milo. I mean, Milo is stuff of gods.
Okay, Emmanuel needs some help finding a home for his discretionary investments. So he's one of two engineers that we're adding to our collection this week. He says, my wife and I have maxed out our tax-free savings account on Ashburton 1200 and Satrix MSCI World, and we're looking for the next best thing to do with extra income. What is your ideal framework for extra income investment after tax-free savings? Is it normal discretionary long-term investments or is it RA? Did you ever find the answer to the tax-efficient way to invest in RAs? Is the 27.5% the best option, assuming emergency fund and other needs are in place?
So it is. I mean, so your company pension, then your tax-free, then RA, and then discretionary ETFs.
So I sent him a link to that article that Harman did for us long ago.
Mm-hmm.
In that... what Harman found was, so he wrote an algorithm, for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, he wrote an algorithm and he found that if you should max out your tax-free savings account first, because there's a slightly bigger tax benefit in the long run, but like teeny, teeny, tiny, it's almost not there.
Just quick aside to that, yes, but if you've got a job, you've been forced to pay into a pension or provident first of all. So this is all the discretionary stuff. Yes?
What?
Well, if you've got a job, a normal job, and you've got a pension or provident or something attached to your job, that payment goes straight off.
Oh, right.
Yeah. But we're talking discretionary here.
Yeah. Okay. So what Harman found, as we've said, is that if you do your tax-free savings account first and then do your RA, when you get to retirement, because this is always the big criticism of RA, is that you still get taxed on your RA money in retirement.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get to retirement, if you do it that way around, then you basically come out ahead in terms of tax. So then Emmanuel he's building himself a little RA on the Signia platform. And this is what he has. Man, I saved it in this thing and it is like impossible to see. So he has Satrix MSCI World Equity. 20% of that, 5% Satrix Emerging Markets. That's so lacquer. I love that. New Funds Equity Momentum ETF at 20%. 30% Satrix 40. So this is a Regulation 28 mm-hmm. compliant product, which is why it's so South Africa heavy. Satrix Property ETF at 15%. And then the Signia All Bond Index Fund at 10%. And that's what his Reg 28 compliant RA looks like. I quite like that one.
Yeah. So he's at like the 25% for offshore, which is the most he can do. You can add an extra 5 into Africa.
Which you could do with those Cloud Atlas stuff if you wanted to.
So he's got his 25%. It looks cool.
Yeah. Did you see my tweet about the Cloud Atlas property thing this week? So it was so interesting. You guys should go and find that on Twitter. The APSA team send us a summary of the ETF market every Monday morning. So they say, in the last week, what happened in the ETF market? And so they say the best performer of the week and the worst performer of the week.
Yeah.
And for the past 3 weeks, the Cloud Atlas... which one is it?
It's property.
Yeah, I think it is the Cloud Atlas X South Africa Property Fund. Was 3 weeks ago, it was the worst performance 3 weeks ago at 15% down. Then in the second week, it was the best performer at 15% up for the week. And then in the third week, it was the worst performer at 5% down. And I just use that. I've used little screenshots from that just to illustrate why it's important not to check your portfolio all the time, because this is short-term volatility, and that is obviously a very volatile product.
Yeah, I mean, today it's up 5%.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a volatile product. Yeah.
All right. The other engineer is Kyle. he has a really interesting question about budgets for us today. His wife recently lost her job. Which scared the out of them and incentivized them to revisit their budgets. He says that they have an incredibly detailed budgeting spreadsheet, like down to the last R1, which is what they turned to when she lost her job. He said that he literally programmed it so that alarms go off when you go in the raid, and he changed his wife's income to zero, and literally alarms went off in his I mean, this is next level Excel stuff when alarms go off. He says, we systematically work through our expenses and 30 minutes later, voila, a revised budget with greens all around. The next step was putting the plan into action, and 1 month later, most of the plan has been executed, which included, amongst other things, cutting back on the food budget. He says, we don't eat less, we're just buying more efficiently. Apparently, you get 50% off meals at Checkers that they are now really using a lot of.
Yeah, my wife finds those.
They changed their bank account to Capitec, and he says the changing the debit orders wasn't as cumbersome as they thought. They reduced their airtime allocation. They reduced their internet speeds. They are paying up and cancelling all retail accounts. They're changing to a cheaper gym. They're driving less to save on fuel. They're consolidating and changing insurance. That's always such an easy win. Mm. Their retirement savings, despite the fact that they've lost half their income, their retirement savings have remained the same for retirement and tax-free savings account. But their short-term savings have reduced by 80%. So he's saying we're still trying to save as much as we can, even just with one income. So they still have their TFSA and retirement money. It's just their short-term savings. He says, while the process is ongoing and it hasn't been easy, what I'm most grateful for is that bloody complex as hell budget spreadsheet. If you lectured budgeting 101 to the masses, how would that lecture go down? What do your budgets look like? How is it structured? Is it Excel or on paper? What are the must-have categories or line items? And do you do your allocations down to the one rand like I do? Or is it a little bit more of an estimate? I would love to hear your take on this.
So I don't budget to the 1 rand. I think I budget to the 100 rand. So I round off to the 100 rands.
So I used to budget every item before. And then I read Sam's book, Manage Your Money Like a Grown Up. And she actually helps me to stop doing it. Because what I realized is, so I would say, okay, this month I'm going to spend 900 rand on petrol. And then, and I'm going to spend 800 rand on eating out. But then I go and eat out too much. And I'm like, no, don't worry about it. I'll just take it from my petrol budget. So I was doing an enormous amount of mental accounting. Now I have an Excel spreadsheet that has my fixed costs for every month. Mm-hmm. Including what percentage of my salary that is, because it's really important for me to see that. And I've got a little visual representation so that I get a sense of the money that I have to spend, where is that money going? And then the rest of the money, I just keep in one big pool and I spend as is. And I've been doing that thing that Stealthy and Patrick recommend, which is to do, I spend on my credit card. And then at the end of the month, I settle and I spend on my credit card and settle. So I've been like a lot more relaxed this year about that sort of thing. And that's worked out really well for us.
And agreed. And to the initial point, I mean, I do broad buckets. So like we have a entertainment bucket or a lifestyle, whatever. And that includes, you know, Netflix, that includes wine and whiskey, that includes eating out and that sort of thing. So it's a very broad bucket. Then there's, you know, and then there's some sort of discretionaries, like sometimes my Uber bill for a month is much higher, and that's either because my wife was using the car a lot or I was traveling or whatever the case was. But I don't go too granular at all. And when I talk to people about budgeting, is what I say to them is start very granular and then move it into buckets, much like you are in a sense.
Mm, that really worked well for that. What's so funny is I made a note here saying I have the fixed expenses budget, which also serves as a checklist for my debit orders. Ironically, this morning I get an SMS, because I put the show notes together yesterday, I get an SMS from Discovery this morning going, oh, you haven't paid your medical aid, which I'm like, what? Like, that never happens to me. Turns out this month I was so trigger happy with my savings that I just moved all of the money out of my account, and like my Discovery didn't go off, my insurance didn't go off, my dread and disability didn't go off. So I was like, oh man, this is so like the one day that I talk about my freaking checklist is now the day that this happened.
It all fell apart.
Oh my goodness, how embarrassing for me. Anyway, that's all we have time for this week and this year. We'll be doing tiny baby episodes over the holidays, just like 10-minute episodes to keep you guys in your fat wallet fix for the holidays. That's it from the Just One Lap team. Thank you so much for all of your support this year. It's been awesome to work with you guys. Remember that this is a show about questions. Send yours to ask@justonelap.com. You can also join the Fat Quality Community group on Facebook. Thank you to Aiden and Kay for your hard work this year in managing that group. My name is Christia van Eerden. Thank you to Simon Brown. Catch you next year.